is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with my co-host, Alan Cobb. And our guest today is Rosemary Lucente, a Fairfield resident. I'm very excited about the next small exhibit we're going to have up in what's called my room, Bill's room, at Icon Gallery. I've been wanting to show this stuff for a long time. It's the work of Rosemary's uncle, Attilio Sinagra, who was a commercial illustrator in the heyday of commercial illustration back, in the mid-20th century is when it was at its prime. Now, I don't even know where to start. All I can say is that you don't see anything like this anymore if you open a magazine or if you go online, because these are the days before there was no online, there was no real graphic design. This was when everything you saw in the magazines, the illustrations of the automobiles, the fashion models, the book covers, the book illustrations, the magazine illustrations were all drawn by an artist who was trained in, it's very fine, I mean, you had to learn classical techniques of drawing and painting to be able to do this. And this is what came out of the art schools back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. The ability to render in, generally it's gouache on board, sort of an illustration, designer illustration paint on board, kind of an opaque watercolor. And the style, when I saw Rosemary's collection, which she inherited from her uncle when he passed away, I was blown away because the look was this exact look that I was in love with when I was a kid, like 10 years old. Yeah, it's
straight out of Look magazine.
Oh, absolutely. And I looked at every detail, see, on the car illustrations and the fashion, everything in the book illustrations, because I wanted to know how to do that. And I would try to figure out how to do that. And then one of the early classes I took in high school was in commercial art. And so we did this type of gouache illustration. I'd make posters and things. Yeah. And it was something that I aspired to.
The subject matter is all cultural archetypes, you know, the dad and mom and the kids and the car.
Exactly. It's the American situation. Way of life was illustrated. And but now Attilio studied at Pratt Institute, which is one of the main schools in the country, and is it in Brooklyn, Pratt?
It's in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
and so the best illustrators in New York City, which did the most of this, came out of there, and he was trained by one of the best, Nicholas Riley, and he studied also with somebody Harvey Dunn, and then he became so good himself. He was invited then to teach at Pratt himself, but for 32 years he was a major commercial illustrator in New York City.
And if you've been watching Mad Men on television, this is where the art for the ads that they're doing came from.
Absolutely. Well, he could do everything. He could do oil painting and he'd even worked in acrylics after acrylics was invented, and he could do it all because the artists that came out of those kinds of programs could do it all. It was a different day and age. Now the artists want artistic freedom and to express their whatever in all these new technologies, but this was the technology. It was, we could prove you could really paint in this style, and I love it. So I'm so excited to be able to show some of this work for a month or so at Icon Gallery. And we're lucky to have Rosemary here today to talk a little bit about it. A portion of the show is going to be auctioned off. Probably half of the show is lent from private collections and her collection. But some of the work we're actually going to, she wanted to actually allow some of this to go out to people who loved it and wanted it. And all the proceeds that come in from the auction, it'll be a silent auction that you can come in and bid on some of these pieces for the month, will go to Icon Gallery and to Dharma Foundation, which is a very great group here in Fairfield that helps students to go to the private school here. All right, Rosemary, where would you begin to talk about your uncle?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about his background in that he was born of Italian immigrants. His parents were from Italy. His parents were also in the arts in that his mother was a haute couture seamstress. She worked in that trade. And his father was a goldsmith. And his father died when he was young. And before he actually went to Pratt, he went to a military-style academy with naval training. And that kind of set him up to be disciplined in his approach to life and whatever he would want to do in his life. And that kind of set a standard for him. So that when he went on to Pratt to start his art career, he was already in that mode of applying himself. And he got the most out of his education by doing that. And he studied under Nicholas Reilly, as you mentioned, but he also went on to continue to study under Nicholas Reilly at the same time that he studied with Harvey Dunn. And both of those teachers were illustrators. They both published in the Saturday Evening Post. Nicholas Reilly was also a cartoonist.
Was it Nicholas Reilly or Dunn or both of them that felt that talent wasn't enough?
It was
getting deeper into the feeling level and the storytelling and all of this that made it transcend just good art?
Yeah, it was Harvey Dunn. Harvey Dunn didn't want to deal. He didn't want to work with any students that weren't already accomplished in technique. And he was, from what I read in Wikipedia, he was a very harsh critic, and that's the way he taught.
That was a popular approach back then.
Yeah, so. And he also was, you know, Harvey Dunn was also had a philosophical approach, and he said to his students that you will never make it just based on talent. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to have that connection with spirit and want to express yourself from that level mm-hmm. of consciousness.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading that. I think that's helped make him more of that whole idea. Took him on to a higher level.
Yeah, he had a very good beginning.
You know, he became a famous illustrator of the time. And he had significant clients like AT&T and the Air Force and Seagram's and the book illustrations. We have a number of the book illustrations and studies for book illustrations that we're going to mm-hmm. be showing. And some of those will actually be available in that style. Were they different books, or was there a certain company that he did all the book illustrations? Because there's a certain kind of consistency. There's kind of a romance novel kind of look to some of these that we have.
Well, you know, one of his programs, his exhibit programs mentioned, I think it may have mentioned a publishing company. I'll have to take a look at that and look up the company and see if it is, in fact, a publishing company. But he was a freelance artist. He didn't work for anybody particularly. Right.
But he would get a
contract
to do some.
He would get contracts. Yeah. He had his own clients.
It looks like he consistently made book covers or book illustrations mm-hmm. for a certain kind of a...
Paperback books.
Paperback book.
Yeah.
And it was so classic. I mean, it's totally classic. You just, oh my God,
I
can't believe it when I see it. But my favorite one of all, I don't know if you
know
what it is, the saloon shootout.
Yeah.
It is like, it encapsulates a period, it encapsulates the style of rendering, and all the action mm-hmm. is perfect. And those days are the days of the Western in our culture, and the Western movie, and Western Bonanza television show, and all of that. It was of that period, and that particular piece completely encapsulates all of these things we're talking about. Yeah. I think it's amazing.
Zane Grey.
But do you know what book that was or anything?
No, I don't. We don't have that information. But I'd like to add to that is that in his education, it seemed under Reilly and Dunn, he had some portraiture classes. And it seems to me when you look at these portraits the style of teaching from his teachers most likely was to inculcate in their students the ability to actually sense feeling and bring that feeling out in their portraits, so they're not stoic.
Right.
You can actually look at the portraits and you're drawn to them, wondering what this person's thinking or feeling. And that particular saloon scene that you refer to is a master character study in itself. There are several characters in there, and each one of those characters is a classic study mm-hmm. of. You could look at it all day long, and
you're
playing the story in your own mind while you're looking at that.
Yeah,
To do what these guys did, because it's almost like the eye of a caricaturist that can capture the essence of a particular mm-hmm. personality or that character. Yeah. But it's not caricature because it's not distorted. But that
it's the selection without the distortion. Exaggeration.
I'm amazed. The first time I walked into your house and I saw these things, I couldn't believe. Because I didn't know what to expect. Somebody's uncle's paintings, and I come in there and this particular thing that is so dear to me, that is of bygone days, it's gone now. Was, living there and some of the best examples of it. So let's see. He did other things besides the commercial things. He went to Venice and did a series of studied drawings in Venice that I think his skill, it's amazing when you see somebody that has this kind of spontaneous drawing skill and spontaneous painting skills, but still gets everything right in terms of proportion and rendering and all of that. It's just
admirable.
Yeah,
it's quite phenomenal, actually.
It's admirable.
To be able to go some... He spent about 6 months in Venice, and he did a lot of painting over there, and he made a lot of artist friends and who had connections with Murano Glass Factory, and he designed his own glass sculptures that Murano made for him. And he also painted and he sketched, and he would sketch with a felt-tip pen, which is amazing. Because
it's kind of a fine felt-tip pen.
Yeah, a fine felt-tip pen. And because you had to get perspective and stance and proportion immediately. I mean, there's no room for a do-over.
Exactly.
And his paintings are just very free. They're very free. And he always felt that, because I remember him saying this, the ability to see is paramount to be able to painting. And... Mm-hmm. I imagine that's probably what he taught his students too. I mean, I have seen some things where some students have really raved about being in his class and felt so lucky to be in his class when he taught. And but the ability to see was paramount. And then he had all these other skills to add to it. And so he got, he was able, it seemed from even very early in his career, to be able to just fluently and spontaneously put something down on paper that was a masterpiece right away.
Yeah, I love it. What was I going to say? In that regard, we're going to have some examples of the instruction book that he actually created on watercolor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he co-authored a. Instructions for Creative Watercoloring or something like that. It's a booklet on he taught watercolor on it. And it was very clear, very lucid. And so I copied a few of those pages with some of his illustrations on there, his working illustrations. And so we'll be looking at that. And then we also have some of those originals, that will be part of the show. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about his working with the military.
At the time of the Vietnam War, he started working as an official Air Force artist with the rank of colonel, and he went on various assignments for the Air Force, wherever they would send him. He went to Vietnam in the middle of the war, in the middle of action, and he was also a fan of, being on the spot and absorbing a scene in order to really, get the feeling, of course, of what he wanted to paint. And so he was really in the middle of action. He was on one of the planes, was called Dragon Ship, that there's still lithographs online of that that the Air Force made available for the public to buy, that he did, his lithograph. And we have in the show a study that he did of that before he did the actual painting. And I remember him saying, how it was a little scary, laying on the bottom of this aircraft because there was no way, on his belly because there's no other way to be in there. And sketching them in action, so he was doing that. And he went to various places for the Air Force, you know, not only to Vietnam, but he went to Germany and Puerto Rico and Northern Africa. And, you know, so while he was there on these assignments, he would also do some personal work. You know, we have a couple of really beautiful drawings of an Ethiopian girl when he was there that we are displaying in this exhibit.
So tell us about his relationship to his hometown, Atlantic City.
Well, in 1968, after he had signed on to take on assignments for the Air Force, he moved back to his hometown, Atlantic City. And he continued to do assignments for the Air Force, and he continued to take commissions and work as a freelance artist. He even for a while commuted back and forth to New York City. And all the while he was building up his career also in Atlantic City, and he took assignments there and did various clients, producing various paintings of scenes of Atlantic City that were then sold as prints. We don't have any of the originals of those things because normally when a client, you know, asks for an artist to do something, they own the artwork. So a lot of his work we don't even know about. We just know what's left was part of his,
so we know that he made thousands and thousands of artworks. And really we just have a little slice of it here. And it's nice that we have a slice of the entire range of work that he did, a slice of his life.
And span of his life.
Yeah,
and
that's fun. And let me say right here in the middle of this, if you just tuned in, that we're interviewing Rosemary Lucente. Her uncle's artwork is going to be on view at Icon Gallery June 7th through July 6th. And there'll be an element. 2013, if you're listening to this repeat in the future.
Or even if you're not.
This is Icon Art Radio on KRUU 100.1 FM, for our station identification. Now, let's go on. I want to hear more about Atlantic City, because he had a dear relationship to Atlantic City, and he hated to see the changes going on. Is that right?
Well, all of us that grew up in Atlantic City had that love for it because it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was a wonderful place. It was a safe place, and it was beautiful. And Atlantic City was well known as the Queen of Resorts and the world's playground. It was, you know, New York and Philadelphia especially, and, you know, neighboring states would all vacation in Atlantic City. And then there came a period when things started to change. And along with that change, you know, and I describe a lot of this process and a lot of the details of this in the exhibit program that will be posted at ICON that everybody can read, a detailed description of what was going on in those days. But the short of it is that he felt very saddened by what he found in Atlantic City, that the decay was starting to set in, the resort crowds weren't coming as much, crime started to go up a little bit. And so, you know, out of compassion, he really wanted to step forward and see if he could in any way inspire beauties of, his feeling of what is beauty, aesthetically, artistic, from all his training, and try to inspire that to remain in Atlantic City, first of all. And if it couldn't remain, if there weren't investors to come in and start rehabilitating some of these really beautiful 19th century exquisite hotels, a lot of which seemed to be modeled after the European culture of Venice particularly, you know, with domes and gargoyles on top of the roof. And so, you know, when that seemed to be failing, then he stuck to it, and then he really tried to help educate those people who made decisions to at least reinstall some beauty, whatever they were going to do. And that desire led to him being invited to be vice chairman of the Art Commission. And so between he and the chairwoman, they worked really hard to try to save some of those buildings in the first place. And when they couldn't, they worked hard to just you know, work with developers and, you know, but it didn't work. I mean, what happened, right? It was just a really huge transition for Atlantic City, a huge turning point. The economy was low during that time. Investors wouldn't come in and take some of those hotels and refurbish them. And then there was the gleam in the eye of the state of making Atlantic City a casino resort. And so there wasn't that inspiration or motivation to do any of those things. And he worked hard, really, for about 20 years to try to, you know, to have a hand in that. There were some small successes, but not enough. Spiritually, it was a huge success because he was really following his dharma and, you know, and planting some seeds, hopefully, for the future. And as a result of that, he, after 20 years, he made a final statement, and the way he made statements was to paint. Mm-hmm. You know, he put it on paper and with ink, with painting, and he had two exhibits, and he exhibited his impressions, and it's very interesting to see some of those impressions because he paralleled some of those adornments that were on Atlantic City hotels that are no longer there with the adornments that were in Venetian architecture. That's one thing he did, and that was the main thrust of his first show. His second show was mainly devoted to contrasting the new buildings against the old buildings that were all dilapidated and decaying. And so it's a record, really. It's an historical record that I hope will be treasured. And 2 years after his death, he passed away in 2004. In 2006, the Atlantic City Art Center asked to re-exhibit some of those things, of whatever was left of that collection. And we're hoping to put them in a South Jersey museum for permanent collection.
And what will we have in our show that
pertains to Atlantic City?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have some prints.
We'll have some of his prints of Atlantic City will be in there. Two studies of one of those rooftop gargoyles with gargoyles and dome, and paintings of the skylines that he did, and he did several of them, actually, because he was, you know, actually also painting the projected designs in addition to the old design. The old designs, the old design skyline of Atlantic City, I imagine he may be the only one that has anything decent looking to look at of those. So they're very, very precious. That old skyline is not there anymore. And you'll see quite a contrast between what was there and a photograph I took of the new skyline that was taken last year that I found online. Mm-hmm. It's quite amazing.
So I don't know how much time we've got, but before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about the poster he made for the Conservation Service. Could you say a thing or two about that?
Well, we found in his effects a poster. It was actually a painting. Whether it was meant to be a poster or not, I don't know, but it was a painting. And so what we've done is, what I've done was to make, have reproductions made of them. And from the beginning of this June art walk, actually probably starting Thursday night, when we will have the gallery walk, that will start to be sold. We'll launch the selling of that. And for the duration of the silent auction, 100% net proceeds of the sale of that reproduction will benefit Dharma and Icon, 50-50, and that will be for the duration of the silent art walk. Thereafter, it'll still be sold, and it will benefit Icon. It's a limited edition, only 600 will be sold. And so it's really a very compassionate painting that's really not affiliated with any cause whatsoever. It totally transcends any kind of commercial use. It just goes right and affects the heart.
But it's directly. A classic, iconic image, and everyone should come and see this. And I'm sure some will want to have it.
Yeah, I was thrilled to find
it. It's
that.
Got an Art Deco look that's like, you know, even though he's a little bit later, he's done this, an iconic poster with mm-hmm. a kind of Art Deco power, and mm-hmm. I really think it's beautiful. So that'll be available. So I will, again, mention what you mentioned. If you're listening to this in prior to June 6, 2013, the show will open on the art walk of June 7th.
And it opens
June 6th, okay, the night before, we're going to have a preview on what we call Icon Thursday. Everyone out there listening should know about Icon Thursday. Every Thursday at Icon Gallery, we have some kind of an event. And that on June 6th, Rosemary and I will lead people through the exhibit and talk about it. She's going to talk a lot about the history. And I'll reflect a little bit more on the feelings that all this work has given me. And it should be a nice evening. And that will be, we'll have our bid sheets up. People can even start to bid that evening. And so I'll once again say that this show is not only an exhibition, but a silent auction to raise money for Icon and Dharma Foundation, that you can come and bid. There'll be a minimum bid under certain pieces, and you can come and sign the sheet all through the month. But on July 6th, is that right? The day after the art walk on July 5th will be our final.
7th.
Is that right? July 5th is an art walk, a Fairfield First Friday art walk.
I believe it's the 7th, isn't it? July 7th, Friday the 7th?
We're opening on the 7th of June,
yeah,
and
sorry.
I think the 6th,
yeah,
it's hard, these numbers, the 6th of July is the First Friday Art Walk of July, and we'll have this up for two art walks,
probably,
but the day to come in and be sure to get the piece you're interested in is on the wait, am I confusing?
I think the 5th,
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Let me start again, the 5th of July will be our First Friday Art Walk of July,
yeah,
and then the next day will be our final bidding party. They can come in, and probably around 4 o'clock, I think we haven't established it, but around 4 o'clock in the afternoon will be the cutoff. So you want to come in,
so
have a snack.
That's Saturday.
On Saturday,
July 5th.
On July 5th.
6th.
6th.
Saturday, July 6th.
Right. That's July.
And you can always call
2013.
641-919-6252, and I will personally tell you all of this if you're confused.
The bidding will actually start next week.
Yes, the bidding will start on the 6th of June. You have a month of bidding and then a final bidding party on the 6th of July. All right. Any questions, just go to our website, icon-art.org.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.